Welcome to Legal Nurse Podcast, where you will get tips to expand your legal nurse consulting skills. Every week, you'll hear from experts from within and outside of legal nurse consulting. They will share their knowledge to help you grow. Your show is moderated by Pat Iyer, a legal nurse consultant with 30 years experience. So, join our community, sit back, relax, and get ready to learn. Here's Pat.
Hi, this is Pat Iyer with Legal Nurse Podcast. Tiffany Hines is with me today, who has extensive experience in long-term care. This is an area of litigation that's so specialized that attorneys who handle these cases usually concentrate on them. There are lots of nuances to long-term care that affect the analysis of these cases. And that's why having a person with long-term care background, such as Tiffany, involved in the case makes so much sense. Tiffany, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you, Pat.
Give our listener a little sense of what are some of the nuances with long-term care records that the legal nurse consultant needs to be aware of. And I ask that question specifically because when legal nurse consultants encounter a nursing home chart for the first time, sometimes they're really lost. There's forms that they've never seen before. What are the things that are unique to long-term care? And first of all, the kinds of forms that a legal nurse consultant will encounter.
Forms that are unique to the long-term care, one in specific is the MDS form. The MDS is a minimum data set, and it's like the blueprint for the patients. It have all the clinical comorbidities that the patient has, if they have a pressure ulcer, if they have nutritional deficits, if they have a feeding tube. It's the blueprint overall for the patient. It's organized in alphabetical order, and ultimately, like, that's the best tool that someone can use or a legal nurse consultant can use to identify everything that's going on with the patient while they were in that facility.
And is this a short form? Is it a long form?
It's somewhat long. It has different sections. It goes from like alphabetical order from A to like F, and even they have a section G. And each section has different areas that will focus on that resident.
Who fills this out?
The MDS coordinator fills this out. And it's done normally upon admission, annually, intermittently if there's any significant changes, and during discharge from another facility or even going home. So as I said before, it's the blueprint that tells everything about the patient. And it's a vital tool to use for an LNC to cross-reference if she wants to look in the medical notes, progress notes, nursing notes, to really get a picture of what occurred in the time frame when that patient was in the facility.
And for our listeners who are not based in the United States, I don't know if there's something equivalent in other countries. This is a government-based form that it took years to develop, didn't it, Tiffany?
Absolutely.
And then
absolutely.
It's been updated several times.
Absolutely.
And it has an impact on reimbursement, so it has to be filled out accurately, completely.
Absolutely.
What are some of the other forms that a legal nurse consultant would encounter in a nursing home medical record?
You have other forms, off-shift forms, that the facility may have within the facility. So documentations that maybe a CNA uses to document the care for the patient. And of course, just, you know, regular progress notes. If the facility has electronic medical records, everything will be computerized. So they may not find any paper documents. Everything will be internally, you know, electronically.
You know, that's an interesting point. I think nursing homes were among the last sectors in healthcare to move into electronic medical records. And I would imagine there's still some that are on handwritten formats, but probably a very small percentage by now.
Absolutely. There are still some stragglers of maybe specific forms, something dealing with maybe respiratory, where there may be a checklist that, you know, it's not in electronic medical records. And it also depends on the facility, you know, their involvement and how much they want or how they want this documentation to be done. And depending on the EMR system that they're using as well. So for instance, Sigma, it's a very user-friendly, majority of the facilities thus far that I know they are using Sigma, and it's where, you know, a lot of all the documentation that takes place, physicians, the nurses, respiratory, physical therapy, everyone documents in the electronic medical records for Sigma.
I know that some of our listeners may be familiar with the extensive United States government regulations related to monitoring the care in nursing homes. Can you tell our listener who's not familiar with FTAGs what they mean and how they fit in with the analysis of a case?
So FTAGs are interpretive guidelines. It's created by the Department of Health, and it's a form of citation during the annual survey that a facility will endure. FTAGs is part of a category of different eras that identifies the care that the facility is supposed to provide to a patient. So for instance, if you have a category of 483.2, it relates to abuse, neglect, and mistreatment. If someone gets an FTAG in that area, it can be a FTAG 609 or FTAG 610, which identifies it was some form of abuse, some form of neglect, some form of mistreatment, or even exploitation that may have occurred in the facility.
And what are the implications, the financial implications for a facility when they get cited for those types of situations?
It's a major financial implication. Of course, the facilities, if they're part of the Medicare and Medicaid services, that will, you know, diminish their reimbursements. So if they're not staying or staying upon or providing the quality care according to federal guidelines, financially, that's going to be a major impact if they're below a certain marking. And it also affects their star ratings. So when someone wants a review of healthcare facility, they will look at their star ratings, and the star rating is based upon quality care and different other components besides just healthcare, but also safety measures within that facility that can affect their star ratings.
How do you find out the star rating of a facility?
Can you repeat that?
How do you find out the star rating?
They can go on the CMS.gov website, or they can go on Medicare.gov, and they can review the annual surveys there for any facility and see also and look upon what were some of the citations, if there were any citations, and the areas of citations.
Can an attorney get hold of reports that may have been written if there was a complaint about a specific resident's care?
An attorney can. They can reach out to the facility directly. And of course, if they cannot, they can seek help from the Department of Health. The Department of Health are responsible for conducting investigations in regards to accident and incidents. And quite honestly, they are more prone to getting certain records that an attorney may not be able to get. So the Department of Health could, you know, actually make an impact in that.
I know that you've had some experience running facilities and dealing with those complaint investigations. What are some of the common types of incidents that may occur in long-term care that could result in a lawsuit?
Pressure injuries, falls with an injury, nutritional deficits, infections, the patient became septic, then eventually, unfortunately, expired. Those are like the common risk errors in a facility.
And we know that a lot of residents fall. And I think the statistic is something like, you know, 1.5 falls statistically happen per resident per year in long-term care. Can you take us through some scenarios where that fall could be potentially related to liability and others where the legal nurse consultant assisting the attorney would say, you know, no, that's a very understandable fall. I don't think that anyone was to blame for that.
So a liability for a fall could be if someone fell out the bed. If they are ambulating and needed assistance and the assistance was not there and they fell, that ultimately resulted in an injury. A fall that just happens could be medical reasons. They got up too quickly. They were dizzy. Unfortunately, they fell. That would not be a liability. It would be just a review on what the facility can do better, whether review of the medication, educate the resident from going from a sitting position to an upright position. Those are some of the scenarios.
I can think about those chairs that I saw in the hospital. We called them Jerry chairs with the high backs and the trays. Are they effective in helping to prevent falls, or do they have any risks associated with using them?
The risks associated at times could be considered a restraint. If that individual is not able to get out of that chair in the event of an emergency. But then it also can be a benefit if this individual is not aware of his or her surroundings, unaware of the potential of falling and hurting themselves. And, you know, after a deeper dive is done and a team meeting is held, including the family, to state that, you know, having them in that chair would be a benefit for the individual. But of course, monitoring still has to be done. They just can't sit in that chair all day long. You know, it has to be intervals of when and why.
I think I know of at least one case where the resident slid down and the tray caught the resident across the throat and strangled the person in that chair, which was a ghastly experience.
And that's why I said it can be identified at times as, you know, a restraint, because if they have on a belt, that's another issue as well, because they can slide down and then the belt could use the place of a tray, unfortunately, and can be a bad outcome. So of course, before getting to those measures or for it won't be identified as a restraint, there's a complete overview that has to be done and documentation to enlist, you know, what are different steps that were tried. Activities, family involvement, you know, despite everything else, that has to be the last resort.
I know when an incident takes place, there needs to be an investigation and reporting to the appropriate agencies. And I think attorneys are often concerned. Was this incident fully investigated? Were there patterns of behavior that are concerning? Was a person appropriately screened prior to admission? I mean, prior to being hired by the facility? Did this person come in with a criminal background and no one knew it? Can you take us through, from your perspective, you've conducted these types of investigations, what are some of the factors that goes into a well-done investigation? And then contrast that with something that might not be well done.
A well done investigation is never perfect, but you do the best that you can. And the first step is to gather all information, not just to jump to a conclusion. So gather all information would look like, you know, review of the documentation, review of the patient's chart, you know, having an interview with the patient if you can as well, interview with the staff. You gather all documents to see what could have been the potential situation. And then from there, you try to get to somewhat of a conclusion of what could be the possible scenario of what occurred and why that occurred. An outcome, a different outcome of that is not doing your due diligence and doing a proper investigation and speaking to all parties and just having this outward explanation as to why it happened, but no facts. There has to be facts aligned with it. There has to be documentation, as I stated before, interviews. Reenactment is a very big thing for me as well. When I was in the facility, I would ask whether if it's a, you know, a patient care aide or even the nurse or the nurse manager, whomever had the involvement with the case and the situation, to reenact what happened, because that also gave me a more visual view of what potentially could have occurred, whether if it was a good thing or a bad thing. And then it also leaves room for education. So if it wasn't intentionally done, you know, at that point, I can educate, or the educator can educate and say, well, in the event next time, do it this way. Because I see when you do it this way, there's a potential for a situation to occur.
Before we continue the podcast, please spend a few minutes getting to know one of the guest speakers who will be presenting at our September 23, 24, 25, 2021 Virtual Legal Nurse Consulting Conference. After you have a chance to meet this guest, we'll resume the podcast.
Legal nurses, are you considering working for a law firm? Do you want tips on landing this job? Do you want to know the inside scoop on the differences between working for a defense firm versus a plaintiff firm? If the answer is yes to any of these questions, then please join Patricia Iyer and I as we host our fourth Legal Nurse Consulting Success Virtual Conference, September 23, 24, 25, 2021, and listen to our experts. Madeline Good has worked as an in-house legal nurse consultant for both the defense and plaintiff law firms. She is currently a legal nurse consultant for the Kelly Ustil Law Firm in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Using her experiences, education, and training as a bedside nurse, in the emergency room, in the intensive care unit, and as a manager and educator, Madeline became a legal nurse consultant, earning her certification as an LNCC, which is Legal Nurse Consultant Certified. Welcome, Madeline.
Welcome, Barbara. Thank you for inviting me to participate in the panel discussion. It's very exciting to go ahead and share my experiences and some maybe little tidbits of information to people that are considering becoming legal nurse consultants. I've had the unique opportunity to be a defense legal nurse consultant in-house, a plaintiff legal nurse consultant in-house, and also an opportunity to own my own business for a short period of time. I have found that my primary role is to review medical records and is to do medical research, retain experts. But what I have found is the way that I do it and attack that information at the different plaintiff versus defense firms is something that I will be glad to discuss in more detail. With regards to becoming a legal nurse consultant, it's primarily the opportunity to share your experience and training. So those of you out there that have had an opportunity to work throughout nursing in every aspect will be somebody who a law firm is going to look for, because cases are so varied. They're not just one type of case. I think that if you join in, you have the opportunity to ask questions and have the opportunity to specifically address your needs and tune in for some pearls of wisdom.
What types of cases have you worked on?
I have worked on baby cases. I have worked on nursing home cases. I have worked on personal injury cases. I have worked on complex medical malpractice issues. Also, what we're doing now is a little premise. liability cases. As you hear in the community, there's a lot of issues regarding safety. And the other cases that we've been involved in are, they reflect what's happening today with some of the condo dangers, because I live in Florida. That's kind of a little snapshot.
Well, you certainly have a very interesting work life, working on so many different kinds of cases and being the expert in the field. If all of you want to join us at our Legal Nurse Consulting Success Conference, you will be able to hear and speak with the experts such as Madeline Good. Please see the link below, lnc.tips/September 2021 virtual. And please know the conference is September 23, 24, 25, 2021. We look forward to seeing you.
Now you've had a chance to meet one of our esteemed speakers for our September 23, 24, and 25, 2021 Legal Nurse Consulting Virtual Conference planned by Barbara Levin and I for you. Be sure to get your seat reserved at this link, http://lnc.tips/September2021virtual. I'll see you there. I can think of a case involving a patient who fell from a Hoyer lift, and the two aides who were involved in this incident were afraid they would get in trouble if they reported it. The patient ended up with bilateral fractured hips that weren't diagnosed immediately. How can an administrator get to the truth about what happened when people are fearful about telling the truth?
I think it stems from the beginning in terms of the relationship the administrator have with the staff. Ultimately, you are going to have individuals who are not going to be truthful no matter what the situation may be. But if you have an open rapport with your staff members, they will feel more inclined sometime to be honest at the beginning and to let them know, you know, it's not always a punishable act. Accidents truly do occur without no malice or no intent. So that's, I think, the first step, which I personally used to, you know, speak to my staff member and say to them when we had an interview, it's for the best of yourself and also for the resident. So I think a good rapport is always a good thing, and having that, you know, appearance in the facility.
Yeah, that's a great point. They have to be able to trust you, and something bad has just happened and everybody feels terrible about what has occurred. And they're fearful of losing their jobs or being sued or some form of retaliation in some other form. It's challenging, I think, to get people to be open when that type of a circumstance has occurred.
Absolutely, it is. But I think, you know, reinforcing that this is not a personal matter. There's no vindication against that individual, but we're working in a healthcare facility where we're taking care of humans and, you know, just overall being in that setting, it does require you to have some form of trustworthiness.
I think another challenge, Tiffany, is that the nursing home assistants who do the vast majority of the work are not well educated, they're not well paid, they have difficult, physically demanding work, they have residents who are not always cooperative, who can be confused and combative. I think it's a very challenging job.
Yeah, absolutely correct.
You know, and what has come out as a result of the pandemic is that many nursing homes relied on family members to help with feeding, to help with care. And when the doors slammed shut and the family members were told last year, 2020, you can't come in, the quality of care in nursing homes was profoundly affected. I just read a report by the Human Rights Watch that they attribute an extra 40,000 people died between March and October because of the lack of resources, the isolation, the depression, the loneliness, just the inability to keep up with the care needs of long-term care residents. I know you worked in this area for many years. What's your take on that issue?
It's a hard position to be in as a CNA. You know, again, as you stated, it's a hard job. It takes a lot, the patient load, dealing with the patient, dealing with the family members. But as a facility, and I will always say this, and I've always told my staff this, the CNAs need to be felt. They need to be a part of the team. They need to be recognized. And a lot of times they're not. They feel that they are at the bottom, low man on the totem pole. No one cares, you know, what they have to say or what they have to offer. And nursing to me begins with that certified nursing assistant. They know the patients in and out and are there with them 24 hours a day and providing sometimes more care than the actual nurse. So recognition about their services is always a plus. And, you know, ensuring that they feel a part of the team.
And yet we know that in the poorer run facilities, the turnover of CNAs, according to the study that I saw recently, could be as much as 130% a year. I'm thinking about what you just said about recognizing them, rewarding them, acknowledging them. I would think that people leave jobs because they feel like they're not getting recognition. Mm-hmm. And they're getting a paycheck. And we may say as administrators, well, you should be happy you have a job. Somebody else will come in and take that job when that individual leaves, hopefully for the facility. And that cycle, that attrition, that turnover is very costly to the facility.
Yes.
You must have seen this as an administrator.
Absolutely. I you know, some facilities, they don't look at staff retention. And that's a major situation across the board at all times. Staff retention is a good key. So, you know, you have to look at what's going on and ask questions. Ask the staff, what is it that we could do better for you as a facility? That engagement is what's missing more than 90% of the time. And some of the reasons why the turnover is so high.
And we know as legal nurse consultants, and Tiffany is an expert witness in long-term care, that the turnover results in some of the more experienced people leaving, that results in more training needs, it results in more resources of the facility being directed to orientation. It results in dissatisfaction among the residents who don't have the continuity that they need. I worked briefly, Tiffany, as a nursing assistant in a nursing home when I was in nursing school. And I think I worked in the facility for 6 weeks, just long enough to get enough money to go to Colorado to visit my friend. And I have a vivid memory of a woman who and they told me in when I was going through orientation, she needs to be put to bed at 8:30. Well, something happened. I couldn't get to her at 8:30. And she was absolutely livid because she had her routine and I didn't adhere to her routine. And what was wrong with me that I couldn't get her in bed at 8:30? And I thought, wow, can you imagine that a whole unit full of people who want their routines respected? And how do you manage that as a nursing home with all those individual requirements. Did you run into this at all, or was this just my unique experience?
No, it was not. It's part of, you know, the independence that, you know, the residents want to maintain while they're in the facility, you know, the same routines that they did when they were at home. And quite honestly, those are some of the questions that I ask the manager specifically, who has the unit for a new admission coming in. When you do an assessment and speak with the resident, if you can, or the family, what are their likes? What are the dislikes while they were at home, if that's, you know, available to us, so we can ensure that the facility is not a facility, it's a home away from home. And what's the best way we can do that to adhere to their needs? Again, communication with that part is a big key as well, because then the manager then speak with the staff on the unit, nurses and the CNAs, to say, you know, we're getting a new admission. This is what's currently going on. This is this current status. This is her likes, this is her dislikes. And what's the best way we can work together to ensure this is what occurs?
It's certainly a challenging environment, isn't it?
Absolutely. That never changes. But there's sometimes ways we can, you know, work around some of the challenges to make the situation a little better.
So the legal nurse consultant and the attorney have this case, and they might have access to an investigation after an incident has taken place. And we've talked about the importance of the investigation and of doing a reenactment. Who could see what, from what angle, what happened? If we think about the regulations, in the multiple policies and procedures that are in place, can you give us any insight about how those are communicated, how changes in policies and procedures are communicated? And of course, that impacts our analysis of what happened, always after the fact when we have the medical records.
So changes in policies and procedures can occur at different intervals. It can be done years later, quarterly, monthly, depending on what that policy and procedure, the title is. But the facility should have some form of meetings in regards to policies and procedures or any changes that's going to be made. And a key player that needs to be present with policies and procedures, meetings and so on and so forth, is an educator. And the educator plays that missing piece, because she or he will be the individual that any changes that's being made disseminates the information down to the staff, so the staff can be aware as well. So if, for example, if there was a change in a policy for a pressure ulcer dressing, the staff needs to know that there was a policy change and how things are being done. It's not being done that format anymore. And the educator would need to be a part of that, including the manager on the unit. I always say the manager as well, because they need to know what's happening on their unit at all times.
And we've got a unit that is primarily staffed by nursing assistants, licensed practical nurses who are in charge positions, and then an RN potentially in the building, potentially available by phone. I wonder sometimes, because I've worked with LPNs in acute care, but not in long-term care, how do they do in terms of the leadership position? Because their education is quite limited compared to what an RN goes through. They're taught primarily to do tasks and not to do assessments. And yet in long-term care, their role is much broader than that. Can you give us any insight into that?
Well, on the units that I typically oversee in the facility, LPNs, of course, sometimes was obviously said that RN. But what I always instill in them is that, yes, you cannot assess, but you can describe. So you have to use the terminology assessment, but you definitely need to describe exactly what you're seeing and what was done. And again, education, even though they may not have the licensure that indicates an RN, but you have a lot of LPNs who are extremely smart, extremely clinically savvy, and they catch on to things rather quickly. So if they are the go-to or the gatekeeper on the unit, you know, education is always key. They have to be informed, be a part of a team as well. And again, they still can provide services. So again, they cannot assess, but they can describe.
We've covered a lot of nuances specific to long-term care, Tiffany. How can our listeners have you become involved in cases? What would be the best way for them to be able to reach you?
They can go to my website. That's www.precisionhc.net. And on the website, they can book a consultation. They can also get me on various social media platforms. And from the website, it will take them straight to the social media platforms as well.
Very nice. I think we've realized in talking that there are some specific pieces related to long-term care that are best addressed and analyzed by somebody who has that clinical background. If you've worked in a hospital all your life and then you get a nursing home case to help an attorney with, there will be things in that medical record that are not going to be obvious to you that they, as they would be to somebody like Tiffany, who has long-term care experience and knows the regulations, understands the environment, and can direct the attorney as to what types of things to consider in the discovery process. So I would urge you, if you're an independent legal nurse consultant with a nursing home case, is contact Tiffany for assistance as a consultant. Tiffany also can consult behind the scenes to help direct the legal team, as well as be an expert witness herself. So thank you so much for sharing your expertise, Tiffany, this program. And I know we just scratched the surface of this topic. There's so much more that we could talk about in long-term care cases, and you've got a great background for helping to analyze those cases.
Thank you. Thank you.
And for you who's been listening to this program, be sure to tell another legal nurse consultant about Legal Nurse Podcast. Tell a couple of your colleagues and give us a rating on Apple Podcasts or whatever platform you're using. And if you're watching this on Legal Nurse Business YouTube channel, give us a thumbs up or a thumbs down and leave a comment. Be sure to subscribe to the YouTube channel, and I'll see you next week.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. Check out Pat Iyer's resources for legal nurse consultants on legalnursebusiness.com. Pat coaches legal nurse consultants so they make more money, get more clients, and avoid expensive mistakes. Check out her coaching program at lncacademy.com. Please subscribe to our podcast and leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Join our community to get notified of each new episode and to receive the transcript of today's program. Complete the request form on podcast.legalnursebusiness.com. We appreciate you and your interest.